What are you guys selling?
If you're drowning and I throw you a life jacket, would you grab it? Yes, good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns?
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show him a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know this.
That's it. I'm done.
Blowing up Big Section Jacks. After Mile, Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 45. Hey, maybe an up day here. NASDAQ Futures up 209. Everything seems to be up today. Oil, gold, everything silver, you name it, it's up. At least for a while. We've seen a lot of stuff fade during the day. Maybe we won't today, but then again, maybe we will. Do we have Kevin? Are you saying Kevin's one of those people that show him 5% and let you watch his kids? I think he is.
I'm not watching anybody's kids. I did my time.
I'm saying you'd let me watch your kids if I gave you 5% return.
Yeah, you can watch my kids. One's in her 30s, the other's in his 40s. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. Good luck with that, eh? Anyway, we have some interesting stuff. We were going back and forth with on the Notre Dame deal. John Feinstein died suddenly, unfortunately. Good guy, huh?
Good author. I have no idea what kind of guy he is. But
well, he's
yeah,
pretty good announcer. I thought he was a pretty good announcer in golf and stuff.
He wasn't really an announcer. He was a writer for the Washington Post. But he
did ESPN and for golf and a lot of and different gigs here.
I don't think he did any of the play-by-play. He was a writer. He's the guy who wrote A Season on the Brink about Indiana and Bobby Knight.
Well, they just rattled off on BBM this morning that he did golf, did some golf tournaments and other stuff. You know, you got a million people in all those holes.
I'll take your word for it.
Well, I'll take theirs. I mean, I don't remember him. He was never in the last few holes, like you say, where you'd remember him. But he wrote for the Post for a while before Bezos. Anyway.
Oh, God, he goes back to when we were teenagers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, he's 69. He wasn't like he was 85. Matter of fact, he died, I'm going to say, young. Anywho, we also had some interesting stuff regarding.
Right. He's our age. He's you know, 1955 birth. So, career. Yeah, I'm just kind of scrolling through this newspaper and other work, print media. He did some stuff for the Golf Channel. Apparently, it was a regular on-air commentator for a number of radio and television shows, Yeah, it doesn't say, you know, it's Wikipedia, so you take it for what it's worth, which is, you know, often not much, but they're usually pretty good on this kind of stuff. They talk about him going on radio shows, doing commentary, doing, you know, different things. But, you know, he's most famous for his writing. Wrote, you know, One-on-One, Moment of Glory, Living on the Black, about pitchers. Two pitchers, two teams, one season to remember, and that was Mike Mussina and Tom Glavine.
Yeah.
So some interesting stuff in there. One book called A Good Walk, A Good Walk Spoiled, Days and Nights on the PGA Tour.
I got to believe that has to be, since it's so competitive. I mean, granted, people have their, you talk about sports and, you know, guaranteed contracts and all that stuff. Those guys, They don't make anything unless they have their sponsors, hopefully, but they don't make anything if they don't win. I mean, if you don't make the cut, do you get anything? You get a little something maybe for your showing up, but that's about it, huh?
Unless the tournament has an appearance fee, no. It's one of the things that golfers have always laughed at the other athletes when they complain about their compensation. Say, you know, try working under our pressure. You show up, you're not getting anything if you don't make the cut. So you got 2 days to make the cut, and if you're if you're just an average golfer, you're going to miss some cuts. Yeah, and even the great golfers will miss a cut once in a while.
Yeah, I remember when I was young, I was really loved watching golf, and I went to see Weston Open a couple times at Beverly Country Club, and Arnold Palmer hit his ball right near me. It was cool, and he sank the birdie putt. Anyway, remember him saying one time in those days, the tournament was not, you know, not the real big ones, but most every tournament was, if it was a $100,000 tournament, it was a big deal. And the winner got 20, I think second place got 12.5, and then it was like 5, then 3 and 2, and all the rest of the schmoes got, you know, 1,500 or something. And he said, you know, it's not, you don't just, I mean, now you can never win one and make, you know, millions a year. I mean, you got to be in the top 15 or 10, but he said, if you don't win the tournament, you don't make any money. Basically, I mean, you had to win the damn thing or at least come in second to get anywhere. I think the first time he went over to, when he, you know, Arnold Palmer, for people who, I mean, the Brits are going to be upset with this, but I mean, he basically made the British Open. He was an American golf star, and he's, now the British Open's been there long before he was, I get it. But he said, if you don't win over there, you know, you can't be like the king of golf. So he packed up and went over to Britain and won over there. But I think his first year, I think the prize, Kevin, $2,500, something like that, $3,000. It was a long time before the British Open, or as they say, the Open, ever came up cash-wise to any American tournament standard, even the small ones. But, hey, you know, I was real interested in the, because this is sort of the, had a lot to do, not a lot to do with my high school, but I went to Marist on the southwest side, and there were a lot of schools in the city. I mean, there was St. Rita, there was St. Leo, there was Brother Rice. So Marist was kind of a new school, and it was in Chicago, but it was absolutely as far as you could get out of the city and still be in the city. As a matter of fact, it was part of a Chicago piece of what was a Lithuanian picnic grove, and then they built the high school there. So, I mean, you made it to the end of the terrain, and that's where Marist was. But most, there were a bunch of guys like me who took the CTA, and the CTA took you right to the parking lot, CTA meaning the Chicago buses. But a real lot of people came from the south suburbs. Those were very vibrant, blue-collar neighborhoods. A lot of people worked at Pullman. A lot of people worked at steel companies. These are places like Riverdale and Thornton or Thornridge and everything. And, you know, when I left Marist, my brother left Marist, the school kind of fell onto, I won't say bad times, Kevin, but those whole areas just went totally downhill economically. I mean, that whole south suburbs area over on the east side, you know, the Harvey, the Riverdales, the Thorntons, the even Lansing, those kinds of places, just talk about degradation in economics. And Marist lost that feed from those whole areas. But they used to have suburban buses, and the whole parking lot would be full of 15, 20 suburban buses that brought people from that area to Marist. And they lost pretty much all of that. And Jim Tyree, a friend of mine who was died young, unfortunately, he was the head of Mesro when we cleared through there. He was on the board of Marist, and he was their big, you know, he said, you guys, we got to go co-ed. And they already had the platform. They had the two gyms and everything. And so they did, and it pretty much saved the place. But their whole demographic changed. And so when you guys were going back and forth about these basketball players, what started this off was Junior Bridgman dying. He was from Northwest Indiana, right, Kevin? And went to one school there, and we started talking about, you know, Quinn Buckner and that group that was at Thornton. They were in Thornton Fractional South, right? I believe. And
No, they were at Thornridge.
Okay, and then with Thornton Fractional had, before that, way back in the day, they had Lou Boudreau and those guys, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, that whole South Side area over in Indiana used to be a real hotbed of a lot of great athletes. Same way with Northwest Indiana. And you guys started rattling off the names, and I'm thinking, wow, talk about shades of time going by. I don't know if any of that's happening. I mean, those whole areas are just, you know, I mean, it's like going to Inglewood, for God's sake, and some of them. It's really a shame.
Well, and I can't say that, you know, that I'm up on, you know, Chicago area high school sports, so I don't really have a clue other than to say, you know, those were some days of some really, really great teams. And, you know, what you mentioned, with when Junior Bridgman died, that sort of brought up the very famous East Chicago, Washington basketball team that they were undefeated and won the Indiana State Championship. And they had three stars on there, Bridgman being one of them, who had a very long NBA career, and he was a really good player, 10 years for the Bucks, among others, I think the Lakers, I think he spent some time earlier in his career. In fact, he was part of the trade when Milwaukee sent Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to L.A. he was one of the players that came back from L.A. in that.
L.A. to Milwaukee, there's a trade for you.
Yeah, how about it? Well, you know, Kareem didn't want to play in Milwaukee. He wanted to play in a big city.
Yeah.
So they got what they could for him, and the Bucks had some pretty good teams in those days. But the other two guys on there, one of them was Pete Turgovich, and Turgovich was a starting guard during UCLA's record 88 game winning streak. He started in the backcourt with a number of great players. The one, you know, one I remember seeing him with was a guy named Tommy Curtis. Turgovich went on. He came back, and he was the head coach at the successor high school. So that, you know, Washington and another school combined, and Turgovich wound up being a longtime head coach there. And the third guy was Tim Stoddard, who went to North Carolina State. And Stoddard was a power forward opposite David Thompson, you know, a Hall of Fame basketball player. And
I remember Stoddard. He was a very solid. He was almost like a, I don't know what you call him, but a big, strong guy.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't he end up pitching?
He looked like your Northwest Indiana steelworkers.
Yeah,
kid.
Yeah.
And Stoddard, you know, he was good. They had a center named Tom Burleson, who was like 7'4". And the year, we remember that year for Notre Dame breaking the 88 game winning streak, but that also snapped a national championship winning streak when North Carolina State won the national championship with that team.
It was Jim Valvano's thing.
Stoddard went on to a long pro career, but it was in baseball. So he played, he played a long time for the Orioles. He played several years for the Yankees. He even had a stopover with the White Sox for a year or two. And he was a pretty good relief pitcher, you know, in the 6'7", 6'8", bulky kind of guy who was very intimidating on the mound. One of those guys who woke up and shaved and still looked like he had 5 o'clock shadow.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There definitely was some hormones going through that guy.
So simultaneously, though, the same group, senior year when Washington was so great, 20 miles to the west, you had Thornridge with Quinn Buckner and Lloyd Batts and Boyd Batts. I think Boyd was the younger brother of the two.
There actually were three, I think.
Three Batts brothers.
It was Lloyd, Boyd, and Floyd.
It could be. Funny parents, huh?
Yeah.
Boyd had a career. He played for UNLV, and you know he was an okay player. Lloyd played at Cincinnati and was, you know, for his career average 20 points a game. Was a really good player, and we know about Buckner. How about commonality with Junior Bridgman? Buckner played for the Milwaukee Bucks for quite a while. Played for the Celtics. He might have won a championship with the Celtics.
I think he did.
And also, when his first 2 years at Indiana, he played football. He was the starting safety on their football team. Really, really great athlete. And so that, you know, that was sort of the era. And everybody had wanted those two teams to play, but it never happened. I think there were some barriers. Same time, in high school basketball in Chicago, you had Gordon Tech. Now, in those days, the Chicago Catholic League was not a member of the Illinois High School Association. So their teams didn't play for in the state championship tournament.
Well, the reason for that was they could give scholarships.
Well, they could do some of that. They could do a lot of interesting recruiting, and then they could play in the Catholic Nationals. So that was their big tournament. And Gordon Tech was coached by a guy named Dick Versace, who went on to become a college head coach at Bradley and a NBA assistant with Detroit and an assistant and a head coach at Indiana. So, you know, it was interesting times. In Versace was known for his curly perm.
White
hair, you know, looked like a human Q-tip. But in the in those days, I remember him coming into our gym and he had kind of straight, longish hair, but not down on the collar or anything, and so we used to chant Captain Kangaroo at him because he had that kind of a look. But they what happened is, another high school basketball story from the era. If you remember, there was a time when the dunk was outlawed in college and high school basketball, and that was because of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He was just dunking over everybody. Probably the best favor he ever got because he developed the skyhook as a response to it. But they weren't allowed to dunk even in warm-ups. It would have been a technical foul. Well, the Catholic League used to play had two varsity teams. They had a 5'9 and under and a 5'9 and over varsity team. Anybody, you know, any size player, if he was really good, could play on the heavies, what they called the heavies. But you had to be 5'9 or less to play on the lights. And so every game was a doubleheader. You'd have the heavies game, and then a break between games, and then you'd have the lights game, and then a break, and then the heavies would come out.
Some guys would play both games.
And some guys could play both. Yeah, some guys were capable of pulling that off, and the refs would be out there when the heavies came out, and they signing the scorebooks and making sure everything was tidy, and then they'd go back to take a break. And as soon as they took a break, Gordon Tech would get out the red, white, and blue basketballs and start putting on a dunk show.
They were, you didn't have breakaway rims, so if you tore down the backboard, you couldn't play.
Yeah, they might have been able to figure out that they were dunking because, technically during war, or they were supposed to get technical foul during warm-ups for doing it, but the refs never saw it. And they had their seven-footers. The star I remember was a guy named Lee Arthur Scott, who I think he played at St. Louis University. I think he went to Michigan State for a while, but wound up transferring to St. Louis. It was fun times, though. There was some really, really good high school basketball.
It's hard to even describe.
There still are. I'm not saying there aren't good, great basketball players today. Of course there are. But those teams were legendary.
Would you even today you see... like Loyola will play somebody, Kevin went to Loyola, you'll see them play a team and everything, it's still got a lot of people show up, but in the early 60s, in the mid-60s, I was young, my cousin was older than me, he played for St. Rita, and the South Side, if St. Rita played Leo at St. Rita's Stadium, the line was two blocks to get into the place, and people were standing on the roofs, it was blue-collar heaven, those football games, and they were for blood. And the St. Rita and Mount Carmel and St. Leo always were kind of the people on the south side that would play against. It was inevitably Fenwick or Gordon Tech on the north side. And Gordon Tech was in an area that they kind of fell out of favor, Kevin, and to where we played basketball right near there, softball. Their football team would be out playing on the same practice in the same field we're playing softball. And they just, all of a sudden, you never even heard of them. And then they essentially got bought by DePaul, and DePaul, the campus was in such bad shape, they bought DeVry went out of business, right? So they bought DeVry's campus and moved DePaul High School to DeVry. And Gordon Tech, I think it's just torn down now. I don't know if it was even...
And actually, DePaul's High School, I don't know what they have now, but DePaul's High School in the day, I want to say it was DePaul. No, it was St. George, I think, that closed. Right before I got to high school.
Well, DePaul had a high school long before my time at DePaul. And then they closed it, and then they decided we want a high school again, and they bought Gordon Tech, and then they moved
They bought Gordon and did that. Okay. And Gordon was, right across the street practically from Lane Tech, which was a very big public high school. And you're right, those games were a big deal, and they were a big deal there were a couple of reasons that worked in the favor. Because in the Catholic League, we played our football games on Sundays, on Sunday afternoons. And the reason for that was, most schools didn't have their own field. I mean, St. Rita did,
They were the only one that I know of.
Pardon?
And it was a crap field, but it was theirs.
Yeah, I remember it. I played on it. Leo had a field.
Leo, you played at Eckersall. It was a Park District field or someplace.
Yeah, I remember playing at Leo, where they had the they had the goalpost bolted to the wall.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of places like Gately Stadium, Lane Stadium, and so on, where the public league used them on Saturdays, on Fridays and Saturdays. So Sundays were left for the Catholic League. But what that got us was, first of all, the Bears weren't very good in that era, and they weren't always on TV because there was, you know, home games generally weren't on TV. So so the football watching was left to us, and then we'd get really good refs, because the refs that would work, you know, like Big Ten games in the on Saturdays, would come work our games on Sundays. So we had pretty good officials by high school standards, and so, you know, the games were really good, really competitive, and really, really well attended.
Well, the I guess the economic, and, you know, as people look at a city like Chicago, and whether your politics are or whatever, you know, it looks like it's sort of on the decline. Well, I'm not gonna say it is on the decline, but that whole area, Kevin, starting from, you know, Bridgeport all the way south and around, east side, all those places were massive blue-collar neighborhoods. You know, when my cousin, he's a lot older than us, tried out for football at Tilden Tech, there was like 250 freshman kids tried out for football. I mean, how many CVS, where Dick Butkus played, was... how many people at school there? 2,000? I mean, this whole area, all these areas, there were all these guys, Catholic high schools, but the public schools had real serious teams too. And CVS had one hell of a team. And it's extended all the way to the southern, all the area which is now, you know, the expressway that goes that way, past Pullman, all in the eastern suburbs. One of my friends from Pullman, a guy named Bob Paschek, real nice guy, real talented guy, This guy, Kevin, he used to piss off our boss to no extent. Our boss had a habit, and he was really fast on the calculator, of reading off like 15 numbers as he tapped them in. He was kind of a nervous kind of dude. Before he hit the total key, Bob would give him the total. We're talking about 4 and 5 digit numbers, and he could add them up as fast as the guy could type them. How many people can do that? Anyway, he was a... Remember Taylor Bell?
Yeah, sure.
Taylor Bell was a guy... He was... Before there was the internet, he was essentially high school basketball in Chicago, the whole area. And he wrote for the Sun-Times. And every... Was it Sunday morning? There was this massive... Well, several-page thing in the Sun-Times regarding every one of these high school games. And he had guys like Bob who'd cover sometimes 2-3 games a weekend, and they were stringers. They figured out who got the points, you know, who had the assists, and maybe a 4 or 5 sentence summary of the game. The minute the game was over, you'd call in to Taylor Bell's assistant, and you'd give them I don't think he got paid. I bet you didn't. Maybe you didn't have to pay to get in the game, but Bob loved basketball. And he did this for years until all of a sudden, you know, the internet and everything else came up. But it was... I'm not saying it was... a better world, Kevin, but the whole area, we're talking many, many square mile area, we're all people, sports, people working. And now it's nothing like that. And, you know, we're talking about, well, from 31st to 200th, and from God knows what, west to east, we're probably talking about a, you know, 15 miles long, 10 miles wide. We're talking about 150 square mile area, maybe 100 of, you know, what, you know, there was factories and factories and schools, and now is... I mean, what do you suppose if you could put the... did some kind of a calculation on inflation, the tax rolls then versus now? It has to be spectacularly higher back then, don't you think, in terms of current dollars?
It did in terms of current dollars, I'm sure. I have no doubt about that. I would also suggest that there's a whole lot of it, no matter what you put on there as the valuation for taxes, where there's nothing getting paid on the property.
Well, there's nothing on the properties, half of them.
Yeah. So you may own the property, and there may be some tax there, but there's a lot of stuff that's just blighted now.
Well, Kevin, there's a kind of the method to this, even though, I mean, we like reminiscing about sports football or sports history, but a lot of what I've been trying to talk about the last few weeks, and we've had some real good conversations, I think, with we're trying to figure out the interplay between the markets, the economy, what people's vision of the future is. You know, it's one thing to And this is not a criticism at all. It's one thing to have policies that you keep trying to change, and maybe you're back and forth. Maybe there is a long-term view. Maybe there isn't. I'm hoping there is. But it all comes down to Kevin. You know, one thing that my background is, you always start counting from the bottom, not from the top. And I really don't understand people who always count from the top. You know, we're gonna have this kind of GDP number. Oh, wait a minute. GDP is the sum of all the other what all the other people do. And if the guy on the bottom all of a sudden can't make it, I don't care what you do to the top number, this stuff percolates its way up. And it's just my training, my background in small businesses and stuff. And I, somewhere along the line, if we're going to bring manufacturing back, and I think we sort of need to with Taiwan, it's all interplay with, you know, international politics and, you know, wars and all kinds of stuff. If we're going to do that somehow, some way, you know, just not, you know, some big, and I'm not saying Trump does it more than anybody, because Pritzker did it. It's not just some huge plant where you get on TV. It's all about individual people saying, okay, wait a minute. Pritzker's bringing his plant here. Trump's bringing his plant here. Are these guys, is this for real? I mean, is it going to be, you know, a place maybe in Wisconsin didn't get as many? Or the Kevin and Chief show, are we going to sit there and go, man, this looks like a winner. We're going to put a saloon next to it. We know that these guys get, one of my clients, Kevin, for a long time, and I think the guy might have died, unfortunately. He was a guy that whenever there was a big thing going up, like United Center or McCormick Place thing, he was a really smart, I don't know if he's an electrical engineer or what he was, but he would look at all the plans, and he would say, these guys, they don't know what they're doing in terms of, like, fasteners. Well, in other words, they'd set out a contract to some guy, and they'd say, okay, you're going to run all these lines, you know, a gazillion lines of wire or whatever, raceways, and for the new McCormick Place addition. There always seems to be a new addition. He'd look at the plans, and he'd go, these guys got half as many of 15 different fasteners. So he would show up in his truck, a big, you know, not a semi, but a pretty good-sized truck. And he'd say, by the way, guys, I read this. It says here you need 1,000 of these fasteners. I think you need 3,000. Guess what? I just happen to have 2,000 on the truck. And the guy had made an incredible living just by doing stuff like that. But you at least need to know that the thing is actually going to get built at McCormick Place before you go out and buy all the damn thing. I mean, there needs to be some kind of certainty here, because some of this stuff is a 6-month business. For this guy, it might have been, you know, order it might have taken him 2 months to get it. But for everybody else, there's this thing you need to do to put your money to work. And oh, by the way, people like us need to be able to go borrow the money, which is a big problem. And since the Federal Reserve has done what they've done with the banks, you and I probably can't get money out of the bank on something like that, or somebody else maybe can, or we're paying 12% when somebody else is paying 2%. All this stuff seems to have degenerated to the point where if you don't kind of fix all that, you're not going to get the explosion in growth that you think you're going to get by starting something up like this. And I'm not criticizing the people, because I think they're trying, and they think that if you bring in some huge thing, it's not the huge thing. It's all the other stuff that goes up around it that people should do on their own. And I think it's very difficult for people to do that now. Am I wrong on this or not?
Well, let's say what's the good news and what's the bad news. As I'm looking at different things, first of all, what I observe, and, you know, kind of our own micro economy here, but there is a lot of economic activity, a lot of investment in the area, and there is other stuff springing up around it. So that's a good thing. In fact, you know, when it's really about, you know, infrastructure. Do you have somebody big who's going to come in and require infrastructure that and then everybody else can piggyback on it? When I say there's good news, the good news, I think, is that the ISM manufacturing index is up over 50 this last month, which is good. That's a positive. But then, if you go look at the commentary that came in from participants in the survey, there is exactly what you're describing. There's a whole lot of uncertainty. So as I look at the comments, let's see, and it's a little bit all over the place. So first of all, the manufacturing is at 50.3, which is good. Actually, January was 50.9, which is, I'd rather see it be 56, like hospitals, but it's not. New orders, a little lower, 48, 50 is kind of your, plus minus territory. Production, 50.7, employment, 47.6, supplier deliveries, 54. So, there's stuff, it's kind of all over the map. So the aggregate looks pretty good. There's a lot of commentary about tariffs and uncertainty around tariffs. There's a lot of other stuff that says business is still kind of slow, but some indications of improved demand are 6 to 9 months out. And there's lead times, so people are in that 6 to 9 month time frame are placing orders. It's a wait and see. It's not, the manufacturing environment, if they really are trying to spur more local investment, we're in wait and see mode. And if they deliver, cool. That's a good thing. But I don't know what to make of it other than to say it's kind of interesting commentary. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, because it's I think it's very difficult for a entrepreneur to string together the financing these days. More difficult than maybe it should be. And a lot of stuff has gotten pretty expensive, Kevin. I mean, when I say entrepreneurship, there's even if I go back to my Pullman days. Pullman was a big they started. Long before me, everything in the railroad car they made. I mean, there were no suppliers, right? I mean, they did the plastering themselves. They made their own upholstery. They had a foundry for the wheels and axles. I mean, as time went by, other people got better and better at that, and they became more and more of an assembler, which you would expect, right? There's going to be somebody who says, "Hey, look, we know how to do lights better than anybody else. You idiots don't have to do them. We can make them and make a profit and do it cheaper than you can do it. Stick with assembling the car or something." I mean, that's how American businesses always have outpaced the world, right? Is having that ability for somebody to look in there and say, "Man, these idiots are doing their own bolts. They don't know anything. They're horrible at it. Why don't I do the bolts for them and sell them the bolts?" That's what is so good about American businesses. And I think because that person could go somewhere, he could get financing, maybe he has to use some of his own, obviously, to get started. But that was not easy to do ever, but it was relatively easy. Now I think it's really hard to do that, Kevin. I mean, in terms of getting the money, the property, getting the people to work for you, getting the training. I mean, not everybody has people coming out of schools like you teaching. I mean, I know my nephew's place here I don't know if they're in Chicago or in the West Burbs, but they go out and hire a couple of people. It's a three-month project to find somebody, and usually they actually bought some other company that had five people working there, not because they wanted the company, they wanted the five people.
Yeah, that seems to be the growth mode. That seems to be how a lot of businesses, almost the first reaction to acquiring the talent they need is to just go buy it, and it very much is. I mean, that's some of the fallout that if you go back to 2007, 2008, and say who survived all of that, and those are the companies with capital, and to this day, the companies with capital are the ones that are continuing to produce because it's so hard for everybody else, and we made it so much harder for people to borrow. It's exactly what you're describing. Where are you going to go get the capital? If it's going to cost you an arm and a leg to borrow, then you better have a wildly profitable business model. And if you don't, you're kind of screwed.
Well, other than me having a smaller brokerage firm and money management firm, and just have always been a champion of small businesses, the way things are going, where you're either like huge or you don't exist, which in some areas is the way it is.
Yeah, I'm not willing to go that far, but But keep going.
But I'm saying it's not my, you know, hatred of bigness, especially bigness that you got because you could borrow money at 2% when everybody else is borrowing at 15. It's just not efficient, Kevin. Because every no matter what big of a thing, there's no way Boeing can efficiently make the million parts that goes into one of those planes. Nobody can. There's going to be somebody that says, by the way, I'm like really good on the windows. Somebody else, I'm really good on the landing gear. It's not just, I don't want Boeing to be any bigger. It's not efficient. It never has been. Because individual people can look at five of the parts and go, guess what? I'm better at those than you guys are. Because they have people that they specialize in that. They go get the machines just for that. And it's not efficient to have these massive, massive plants where they do everything without other people being able to participate. It's not just because you're keeping them out. It's just not efficient, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, Tom. Big part of it is cost structure. People, we don't really have great ability to make high-quality products either. And companies are, you know, many companies have figured out that equation and that profit model, but there's a lot of them who haven't. And so that's the other thing is people don't understand, they don't understand their own cost structures, and it's killing them.
Well, yeah.
I have some acronyms that the first two that I stole and the other two that I invented that I use in quality classes. So the cheapest way to make anything is called DIRFT. Do it right the first time. It's expensive to do it right the second time because you have to send everything back and rework it, and you're only getting paid for what you for what you sell, not for the expense side that's the expense that's embedded in it. But then the third level is called TIASO. That's throw it away, start over. So that's a really expensive way to make things. And the fourth one I call RIFPOC, that's returned item from pissed off customer. And that's even more expensive. So, you know, it's that model. There's too many people living in, and that's one of the traps of the small business model that you described, is there isn't necessarily a sophistication in there. Some people really understand how to run lean and use the lean concepts and the lean tools that they need to be able to run a business, but not a lot do. You get the entrepreneurs who are very seat of the pants, but they're not formally trained in that kind of stuff, and so they don't really even understand their own cost structures.
Well, they also, you know, a lot of what goes on in small businesses and some of the things that I found was very, very illuminating, especially since Pullman was a long time ago, but my nephew is in this place, and I've gone to some of the machine shows with him, which are pretty fascinating, by the way. What you find is if you've never done it, and any business doesn't grow, I'll say, linearly. And I don't know if you teach this, Kevin. There's always a step function. You know, we get stuff from other people's places that have these big machines, and they break. And we've got two engineers here and three guys that know how to work any lathe and any machine there is. Plus, we got some of these new machines that will do just about anything. You program the damn thing in there, and it'll make a part for you. I mean, it does. Of course, it takes, it may take an hour to make the part, or 2 hours, or whatever it is. But they do one hell of a job. The thing will drill it, it'll do everything. I mean, they're fascinating. Have you ever seen one of them work? They're all digital. That's what my nephew's pretty good at, is programming those things. So, but then all of a sudden, somebody goes, well, we want 50 parts. You sit there and go, well, I'm not going to use that machine for 50 parts or 100 parts, and I don't want these guys, you know, the blacksmith shop doing those on old lace, which you can do just about anything on. Some guys can. All of a sudden, now we need, like, another machine. Well, how much is the machine? Oh, let's take a quarter mil. What? A quarter mil. All of a sudden, this machine can do this stuff at some kind of speed. Okay, now wait a minute. Are we getting one 100-part order, in which case this $250,000 machine's going to, we're going to hang our clothes on it for the next 5 years, or what are we doing here? Now do we have to go find other people that now our marketing has to expand to a different area where now we are, I won't use the term mass-produced, but somewhat mass-produced, those are different than our normal customers. Now do we need to hire some guys that we actually pay to drive around to go to those places and say we, it's always that next step, Kevin, and it's never... You can spend, you know, $100,000 a month this month. You can't spend $101,000 next month if you're going to grow. It's going to be $150,000 or something, right? It's I mean, that's very, very difficult in business. And if you screw up the step, if you expand just when the business comes down, I'm going to guess you're probably out of business, right? On what you thought was going to be a good year. I mean, it's really difficult.
Yeah, so you can overexpand your fixed costs. Now, you know, you can. There's a lot of technology available in the manufacturing world now that allows you to flex up and flex down without, you know, there's a lot of fixed costs to it, but at least you've shifted your model to pretty much variable, that when you want to expand, you just ramp up, and you're able to, you know, you're able to move ahead. But, you know, again, it's expensive. It's expensive upfront investment. If you're willing to recapture an investment in 5 or 6 years rather than 2 or less, you can thrive in there. But you have to be willing. The model historically, you know, look, I remember the days when capital expenditures, I had to recover them in 3 years, and everybody'd be happy if I could give a proposal that was a 3-year recovery. You know, eventually it got to be better be 2 years, and gee, we'd really like to see it in 18 months, and 12 would be even better than that. So, you know, that became the model for, you know, making investments. And if there are companies now, more of them, that are willing to invest in the kinds of technology they need to be able to control their own fates as things grow and things expand and contract, and if they recover it in 4 to 5, they're okay with it. It's a way different thought process.
What about the mental part? And it's kind of what I wanted to get to with you, because you're obviously in the school that does stuff for everybody. It's not just, I mean, in my generation, you know, working with your hands was not something that wasn't looked down on, okay? I mean, it definitely wasn't. You know, the idea that everybody had to be an accountant or a lawyer, that was not the drill. But over a period of time, it's not just that, you know, one group gets dirty and the other one doesn't. If you were in that group, say, from 1960 on, every year in this whole area I'm kind of talking about in Chicago, this big, you know, bazillion square mile matrix, every year the jobs got less, and every year people were laid off. And a lot of those businesses, you know, because, you know, the government was supposed to help out, they didn't, but they totally screwed a lot of these people in their retirement. I mean, some of these steel companies, they did all kinds of crap, Kevin. I mean, remanufacturing, they were on the south side. They offered everybody, where did they move, to Mexico or New Mexico or some damn place, and then offered everybody a transfer, and half of these people are 62 years old. They're not going. Well, then they said, okay, you're not getting a retirement or something. I mean, they did stuff you would never believe. Some steel companies, same thing. They ended up dumping them on the government pension plan, which is, what, about a fifth of what they were supposed to make. So the bad taste in your mouth had nothing to do with, you know, you had to wash your hands more after you're doing that kind of work. But I don't know if anybody, if you and I drop back to when we were, you know, 35 years old and maybe having kids, you had some, I didn't, I don't think we would ever want our kids in that industry, not because it wasn't fulfilling or because it wasn't a good job, it was because it seems like every year there's less of them. There was no future there. Now, we're trying to bring some of this stuff back. Is it enough for, if you and I went back to child making years and had 7 kids lined up, we never want 7, are we okay with 4 of them saying, I want to work in a factory, and without thinking, hey buddy, that factory's gonna be closed in 5 years? I mean, when are we going to change the mental bus around enough to where this become career? Right now it sort of is for people who just moved here. I'm not talking about the border and all that kind of crap. I'm just saying, for people who are kind of first generation here, they seem more willing to do this. Not because, you know, they like getting dirty more than anybody else. It's because it's a good job, and by the way, it's a hell of a lot better than what I had, and if it's not here 15 years from now, I'll deal with it then. But those of us that like to look further into the future are saying, I don't want my son or daughter, age 55, as a engineer of all these huge machines in these factories, and one day you walk up and the door's shut without any place else to go. I mean, I think the mental hangover here in Chicago is huge about that. What do you think?
Well, it is, and you also have a lot of parents that raise their kids, and the parents may have worked in factories for a long time, and they're saying, I don't want my kids to, you know, to have to do what I did, because it was hard work and it was dirty and all that. Well, you know, some factories still are dirty, and you know, certainly there's a lot of hard work to be done, but by the same token, not all factories are dirty, dingy places anymore. Some of them are sparkling clean and really interesting places to work. So you have to overcome that stigma to some degree. Part two of that is, and this is where AI, as it sits now, you know, the state of it now, is making inroads. We're used to automation replacing people on the factory floor. We're used to the robotics and all of that, you know, taking a piece of that. What is happening now, though, is you're starting to see a lot of those tools are reducing the need for office staff. So now we're starting to lose jobs, you know, get replacement jobs in the areas of, you know, in accounting, for instance, bookkeepers. Yeah, where you need bookkeepers when you can have a computer just kind of gather and do. And you have really good integrated ERP systems that, you know, handle all of that on a very automated basis. There's a lot of functions like that where, it's really easy to do it. You're doing things with fewer people. So the question is, who's going to survive? And I would say, under any circumstances, who's going to survive are still, and this would always be true, can you, first of all, can you implement things? That's the biggest thing. When I talk to people, whether it's small businesses or larger businesses, I can always ask the question, got a lot of good ideas, a lot of things that need to be, you know, changed and implemented, and people have ideas for what to do. You got that at your place? Yep. Any of them ever get implemented? Nope. So, you know, people who can manage projects, who can organize teams, who can work well in teams, work well in diverse teams. And, I don't mean that as a DEI play. I just mean your workforce is going to be very racially mixed. It's going to be, it's going to be men and women. It's going to be, it's going to be age. You might have four generations, you know, working together in the workforce, and different outlooks that come with that. So if you can lead project teams and implement stuff, and work well with all kinds of people, then that's going to have value. If you provide great customer service both inside and outside of your company, that's going to be valuable. And so those are the skills that you really have to have. The rest, almost everybody says, if you can do that, if you can do a little research and come up with some solutions, if you can speak in front of a group of people, if you can write reasonably well, not short novels, but you can write up a proposal or something like that. Those are the things that have always mattered, and they matter all the more. That's what's going to survive going forward in the workforce. And so I can train people for a lot of skills, but it's really trying to emphasize those, because everybody I talk to, those same people that said nothing gets implemented, says, I can teach the technical skills at my place. I can teach people what they need to do. I just need people who show up on time every day and do that stuff.
Well, you also, I think some of the basic skill levels, I mean, and again, my mentality is I'm going to say it's warped, because it was at a time when you know, if you owned a fence company, your kids could go to the best college, and even if they came back to run the fence company, at least they had heard of all the, they weren't masters at accounting or marketing, but they at least knew enough about it to know whether their guy was doing a good job or not, and what they needed to run the place. There was I think education for people at every level. I've always been a real proponent of that. I mean, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. My mom was taking classes at St. Xavier's at night when she was 80. You know, so whether it was history or whatever it was. And I think, but the idea now where there's such a split between this 75 grand a year it's some of these places and not going or whatever, is, you know, and then we ended up stuff, is education worth it? Well, it's not worth it at 75 grand, probably. Maybe, I don't know, depending. But I mean, we've let costs get into this argument to a huge extent, which is what your group is essentially trying to negate a little bit, right? You've got education for people, it doesn't cost them a lifetime of debt, and I don't know how we ever got there, Kevin.
A lifetime of debt, and they can on ramp and off ramp as they need to. So, you know, in the supply chain world, I don't, but I do in the IT world. But I get the, I get the young people, the ones coming out of high school, and I've talked to guidance counselors there, and I tell them, I love teaching your A students, they're easy. But you know what? Send me your C students, because if you give me a year with them, I don't need an associate's degree. I can get you a year with a certificate and some industry certifications, and we'll send them out in the world ready to work, and that beats the crap out of working in fast food. So if you got your people that don't want to go to college, let's get them into something that's going to start them on a career path. And then if you still, you know, now you start seeing yourself as, you know, in a leadership role or leading projects or any of those, then send them back to me. You know, send them back and we'll skill them up again. And you just talked about your mom and lifelong learning. Lifelong learning is a career strategy too, and it's really, really important. And that's who's going to survive, and that's how businesses are going to survive. You know, I've got one business. I've probably taught over, I would imagine I've taught 150 of their people at this point, because they keep sending them back, and they come back for academic credit. But, you know, this semester I've got a Tuesday group and a Wednesday group. They show up at 1 o'clock, and I have them till 5, and they're on the clock at their business. But they're taking courses from me, for academic credit. And then, you know, I've got another group with another professor who works for me, and so he's got another group from the same company. I think I have 16 in one class and probably about 8 in the other. That's a substantial investment on their part, but they're recognizing what they need people to do.
Kevin, we only have a few minutes, and I'll probably go into more of this with Carl, but we talked with a different bunch of different people this week regarding saving costs at the federal level, okay, or the state level or whatever. And for whatever reason, maybe because on the show we've been talking about it more lately, but I've been getting people who listen are hearing stories about friends and family or maybe themselves. I'm hearing more and more stories about people have medical issues and what they're going through. If we don't find somebody, and maybe this guy's the guy that finds a way, and I'm shuddering where the current people in Washington are making it sound like they're going with this, is we're going to cut back a lot of Medicare and Medicaid support. That's not, I'm not going to comment on whether that makes sense. If you don't dig into the real issues here, the thing that I'm sensing, Kevin, is people are telling me stories about care for people. One guy used to trade on the trading floor. He knows me, and evidently told his story to somebody so they'd know to get to me. The dude was walking around, and he's having, his chest is feeling a little, he's getting short-winded and all this kind of stuff. And he goes to his doctor, and the doctor says, "Well, you need an appointment with a cardiologist." He goes, "Okay." Well, they make an appointment's like 4 months out. Okay, every specialist now, hopefully you haven't had to do this because I haven't recently. Somebody wrote in that they're seeing one of, they have an AFib, and they live in Oklahoma. They listen to the show. They go see somebody at the University of Oklahoma. Yeah, I got the message in January that their appointment's in May. Well, that's a long time to go if your heart's out of rhythm, for God's sake. But this guy, somebody says, "Hey, just go to one of those urgent care places." Which those things, I think, do a pretty nice job in a lot of areas. I don't know how it dovetails your insurance or whatever. I don't know much about it. But so the guy goes in there. The dude goes, "How the hell are you still standing? You better go to the emergency room, like, right now." What the hell, Kevin? Do we hope the guy croaks or what? So we don't have to deal with him? Or what are we doing with this?
I thought we took care of that during the COVID times when we.
You know what? They've never come back, and the costs are. And one of my buddies had a heart attack.
No, I'm talking about killing all the older people.
Yeah, And he was in.
Who have all of that, all of those kinds of problems.
Well, he was in Northwestern, then he went to the rehab institute at Northwestern. So I go visit him. Somehow the reception area is like on the 10th floor. You know, I'm not an architect. Kevin, I pile up to the 10th floor with a buddy of mine, and we're going to go see this guy. The floor, I don't know how many square feet are in the floor. There's like maybe 10 seats to sit down with this beautiful view. And there's a desk in the middle with three people in it. Kevin, there's got to be 250 by 100 square feet, and there's five people there. I mean, we'll talk about overbuilt for you. I mean, what are we doing?
We have a bleeped up model for healthcare? Yeah, gee.
But how are we going to...
So when you say you don't know if we have the guy or not, we don't have the guy until the guy does something.
Well, I don't even know how you... But if I'll talk a little more about this, you know, because Carl's all over this, but Carl can be a little aggressive on putting people in jail and stuff. The fact is, and the thing that struck me this week, because somebody hit me up with this blood thinner stuff and how much it costs. And I wonder, Kevin, honestly, if the slowdown in the economy we're seeing in January, February, and March has something to do with everybody. Older people are on a whole bunch of medications, right? It's something to do with the first two or three months, it's all on you because your deductible is so high. Everybody over the age of 65 doesn't have as much money in January, February as they do the rest of the year. And I don't know if it's massive amounts of money, but it's a lot. I think the deductible for somebody on the Medicare Part D is like $590. So if your prescription bill in January is $590, it's all on you. Well, if you're on Social Security, getting $2,300, that's a chunk. How the hell do you pay your rent in January?
Well, who are you going to stiff becomes the question. And
yeah.
That's always the question in a bad economy.
So, I mean, if you look at this, I did some...
So the first thing you do is you put it on the card, and then you stiff the credit card company.
But I did a back-of-the-envelope crap, and these are the two drugs that are the blood thinner stuff, Zeliquis and Xarelto. They're both about, well, they're $690 a month. I think the guy told me that his Medicare, they're $590, so you get a little discount. All right, so say $600 a month. Well, that's $7,200. You essentially split it with Medicare, so you're up. It's $3,600 a piece. You're paying, and Medicare's paying. So Medicare is paying $3,600, and I looked, and there's something like 25 million people on this stuff. And this is one drug. We're not talking about a chemotherapy that's $50,000 a pop. This is one drug that virtually, I won't say everybody, but a significant chunk of the older population is taking. And allegedly costs these people $18 a year. I mean, I don't have a problem, I guess, if you got too many people working in Washington in a department paring down the place, because every once in a while things get bloated. I get that part. But we're not talking a pimple on the ass of an elephant compared to what we're paying in this drug. And this is just one of them. How many more out there, for God's sake? I fortunately never been on Lipitor and those kinds of things. How much were those things before they came off patent?
Oh, expensive. So, did you see the note I sent you yesterday?
Which one? I saw a bunch. I was reading about the basketball.
I think it was yesterday. It might have been with Russell that, you know, what are they doing differently in Canada? Well, Canada actually has 20 years of patent protection, but they also have price controls. On drugs, so that's how they keep the prices low. And then, as a U.S. consumer, if you can't afford it, then you can usually go to a Canadian pharmacy and do it via the mail. And nobody seems to be cracking down on it, although it's technically not legal. So,
well, you have to get a guy up there to give you the prescription, right? He has to agree.
They'll take a prescription. They'll take a prescription from here.
Well, I thought you needed somebody to kind of Well, that's the veterans. If the veteran guy has, in order to get your veteran stuff, you got to get a veterans doctor to say, yeah, you need it. I mean, I don't know what the first move would be, Kevin. I don't even know if you went in front of Congress and said, what do we change first? Well, I mean, I have you know, some friends now that are on the, I keep saying I shouldn't say it, the fat cell drug, the weight loss drug, right? Kevin, the thing's $1,000 a shot, and it costs five, according to the lady who wrote the article on CNBC. I mean, I don't know how we can afford that. I'd much rather have three or four extra people in the Forest Service than I would be paying these guys a grand for something to cost them five, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, no, Tom, you have to allow for all those development R&D costs.
Yeah, what a bunch of crap that is. I mean, I don't know. Would you?
Well, I mean, this is we are getting exactly what the system rewards. So it shouldn't be a surprise. We have a system that grants patent protection for years with no regulation. And how many times have I told you on the on these very airwaves, and I know you agree with it, is if you're going to do business, if you're going to get government largesse, then the government does have the right to, in exchange for that largesse, in this case patent protection, has the right to have some requirements built around those. And if you don't want to work that way, okay, don't.
We've seen it. We got to get to Carl here in a minute, but we've seen these drug guys, heads of drug companies, be yanked in front of Congress, and all these people, they're talking head idiots in Congress. They're not idiots, but they sometimes when they don't ask the question...
They're grandstanding.
Grandstanding. If you get 10 guys in a row, how come there's not a Tom Howell or a Kevin O'Neill that says, all right, you're in front of Congress, you're under oath. Tell me, this drug that you charge, this chemotherapy that my mother's on, if my mother was on it, it was $50,000. What does that cost you? I mean, if the guy might say, "Well, I'm not at liberty," give me a ballpark. Don't tell me $1,950. Is it $10? Is it $48,000? Give me a number, because if you don't, I'm going to go find out.
Well, and part two of that is, okay, tell me what the R&D cost was behind it. Tell me what the cost of running a trial was behind the drug. And if you want to say, well, you have to allow for all the things where we do R&D and we don't recover it. First of all, companies do R&D that they never, for products that never come to fruition all the time. And so I don't know why a drug company would be treated any differently, but let's even allow some of that to be absorbed. You still have to justify the financial model behind it, and says, okay, I'm charging $50,000 and it costs me $25 to make, or whatever the amount is, or it might cost me $2,500. I'm still charging $50,000. That's a hell of a markup for a product that I have given you the right to sell without competition.
Well, not only that, it might have come from a university, the initial part of it, that the government paid for the research.
Yeah, could be. So, the point is, look, there's lots of ways to skin the cat. And, we've all offered opinions on that. And Carl's got some great stuff. I've got some premises that I believe in. How much of it can they solve? I don't know. How much power do they have to overcome of the pharmaceutical companies that are behind this? And look, the media. How much media is dependent on pharmaceutical advertising? Do you think don't get their arms twisted about how they report on these companies? Because they're going to be out of business. They're going to have a real hard, let me put it this way, they're going to have a really, really hard time with their revenues stream if they don't have people dancing and singing about their A1C every 5 minutes on TV.
Well, before we get, Carl's probably going to like this one, so I'll give you one more minute and then we'll dash over to him. When my mom...
jump in, because we're way over time, so...
He's there if he wants to pipe in. My mom was... she ended up having lung cancer from years of smoking, even though she had quit for 12 years. It still came in bitter. But this was back when the mesothelioma stuff was, it's still happening to people.
Well, of course.
And I asked the doctor, the pulmonary guy, I said, just out of curiosity, because I was doing a show with John on the air, I said, when you guys get a mesothelioma patient, because there's essentially billions of dollars in this, for lack of a better term, a trust to pay off legal stuff for people who had mesothelioma. And people who you never even dreamed died of this. Did what's his name? Merlin Olsen died of it. He helped a pipe fitter one summer when he was in high school, and so did Johnny Lattner too, right, Kevin? He did the same thing. He helped a pipe fitter when he was in high school. Anyway, so I said to the dude, I said, you know, if you run up in those days, a $50,000-$100,000 tab and Medicare for somebody who has mesothelioma, does the government get a contribution back from this trust fund? And the guy looked at me like I had 15 heads. Why would we do that? And I said, well, because the damage that the drug has caused, or the asbestos has caused, is, you know, it's not just to the surviving family. We're the ones that have paid the $500,000 to care for the person for a while before they die. Why isn't part of the $500,000 part of that fund? I mean, that's where the expenses are. He had no idea what I was talking about. He said, no, we never report anything like that. Why? I mean, these are...
Well, so basically, the problem you have within the medical system when it comes to pharmaceuticals today, okay, is that the standard pricing model that is used, and when they've hauled these guys in front of Congress, they've told them this. They take the actuarial value of your remaining life, and let's say that, you know, you have cancer, you're 50 years old. The actuarial value, if you did not have cancer, would be, you know, 74, right, is what Social Security says you would on average live to, all right, for when you were born.
Well, it used to be going higher, now it's going lower, right?
Well, yeah, because we killed a whole bunch of people and gave them really bad forward prognoses due to stupid things that we did over the last 5 years. But, you know, so yes, and by the way, that damage is not gone for those people who think it is. It's not. It's still showing up. And so it hasn't started to come back down. So God knows where the knee point is in this thing. I mean, there is one. But, you know, are we going to find it in 10 years? Are we going to find it next year? Are we going to, I don't know yet. But let's just take 74, okay? But you have cancer now when you're 50. If you don't treat it, you're going to die in a year. Okay? If you do nothing, you're going to die in a year. If you treat it and succeed, 74, right? All right, now this is an actuarial.
Well, it depends on how much the chemotherapy buries everything else in your body.
Well, I know, but, you know, yeah. They conveniently ignore that stuff, right? You know, the chemotherapy, you know, oh, well, that potentiated a latent cancer that you had, and, you know, and then 5 years later, that whacks you, right? So, but the thing is that we have this data because life insurance actuaries compute it every single day. It's how they sell life insurance, all right? I mean, for Christ's sakes. All right, so they say, well, this thing has a 30% rate of giving you a durable remission. 3 out of 10, which is really not very good odds, right, if you think about it.
Well, it's better than what it used to be, 0, pretty much.
Well, 3 in 10 beats 0,
yep.
Right? All right, so we multiply by, you know, by 30%, and oh, by the way, that because those are high earning, high spending years, we value that this extension, if you get it, would be $1 million. All right. Well, 30% of that is $300,000, right? Therefore, we can charge $300,000.
You couldn't do that if it was competitive. I wish I could charge whatever I wanted
Chief,
to.
Yeah. Chief, this is repeatedly how these guys have admitted to doing their pricing schedules.
That's unreal.
And this is not a one-off. Okay, this is I have heard multiple hearings in front of Congress where this is what they do. They take the public actuarial data, which everybody has access to. There's no secrets there, all right? That data is used. I mean, you know, if you get into a car wreck and, you know, your kid gets killed, this is how the lawyers figure out how much to sue for, right? If it's the other guy's fault. So,
well, it sort of used to be. Now you go onto the jury and it doesn't. Well, if somebody never had a job in their life, they're going to get like $50 million or something.
Well, and that guy was such a bastard; he deserves to be spanked.
Yeah,
right? but I mean, that's the non-economic damage thing. But the economic damage is something that we actually we have a pretty good set of data on. All right, I mean, it's that's what those guys do as a job. It's you may say, well, that's morbid. Well,
let me back up just a hair, Carl, because I think we blew by that too fast. For people who don't understand where we're going with this, there was a time, and still there is, a formula that if you get run over by a car that went through a red light, and you're 50 years old and you're making $200,000 a year, part of the damages to the family with you being gone is you're going to work another 15 years for $150,000 a year. You kind of start at that point, and that's why a person who's making $200,000 a year generally has a higher starting point than somebody who's making 50. It doesn't make him more valuable as a human being or anything like that, but in terms of what are the damages to the family, who probably has a house that's bigger and has a mortgage that's bigger, they start with that. Then if it was egregious and if the person was drunk or God knows what else, you might add on top of that. But you start out with some sort of a base. What are the damages for the next 25, 30 years?
Yeah, you have economic and non-economic damages. Okay, but so the thing is that this is part of the way that the medical system has evolved, okay? And there's... That is, I mean, I understand the argument on the on that side, and this was one of the things when.
I understand it in a non-competitive world, but you don't get to do that. I don't get to.
Well,
when
in
I do
a non-competitive world, you shouldn't get to do that, Chief.
I mean, I would all love right. to say, let's see, you want to buy 100 shares from IBM PTI today? I'd love to say, well, I need $2 million. We need a building, not just an office. And work back to how much I charge you. I'd love to be able to. Actually, I wouldn't love to do that. But some people think they have the right to do that.
There are a lot of people. There are a lot of people that think that's a grand idea.
Yeah, it's okay? a grand idea. Yeah, it is. Except there's somebody else. So I charge you $500 for $500 for the 100 shares IBM. Guess what? I'm never going to get a client ever because somebody's saying I'll do it for X.
Well, exactly. And that's. But see, here is, and the thing is, people say, "Well, this is just a pad." Well, no, it's not. Look. I've been on this this attack point for a very long time. Okay, that this escalation is absolutely the cause of the deterioration in our fiscal situation in the United States,
without a doubt. The more I was just saying to Kevin, the calculation I did on two drugs, it's got to be billions of dollars.
Well, and here's the thing: is that all systems, when they become protected from competitive forces, and then you add this kind of a structure into it, you get parabolic accelerations. It's an exponential process, because if I made 5% more this year, then next year I have to make 5% more, but it's off to this year's base. All right. And so we have this kind of an increase. And once this stuff starts, and I detected this back in the 1990s when I was running MCS, and I was apoplectic over it because I knew where it would go if it wasn't controlled. Okay, and again, this was 30 years ago. And I was like, look, the data, it was already in the data at that point. And I said, now, this today... This is a pain in the butt. I've got to write the checks to the insurance companies, et cetera, as a CEO. But I can manage this. This isn't going to put me out of business. Right? This is not going to destroy my company today. It is going to destroy everybody 30 years from now if it doesn't stop. And it not only hasn't stopped, it's accelerated. Look, when you look at the MTS, we just got the latest numbers, right?
I've got them up here. Don't you're going to talk about them.
Yeah, well, you knew I was going to go here, right? Because, we've been chatting about this.
MTS, monthly treasury statement.
Correct. It comes out every month. And prescription drug spending in CMS, which is Medicare, right, and because and Medicaid isn't in that figure, and the reason is Medicaid's a block grant, so it's not broken out. The amount, the percentage of what goes into Medicaid, both from the federal and state side, that ends up as drugs, there's no way to separate it out with the data set that's in the MTS. However, Medicare Part D is specifically broken out, all right, in CMS. So you can see that part of it. Over last year, the current run rate is an 80% acceleration to this point this year. We have currently spent $74 billion in this fiscal year since October 1st. Last year, that was $41 billion, and the entire spend last year was just over 100.
Well, I've identified two drugs, Xarelto and Eliquis. If they charge 1,000 instead of 7, let's say they save 5,000 a year, it's $20 billion. It's two drugs. How many drugs are out there, for God's sake?
Well, a bunch, right? Yeah. So the thing is, and by the way, you're only looking at the, you know, this is only that which is in Medicare.
How much it's kind of total, but
But I'm saying the fiscal impact on the federal government is only for those people on Medicare. It has no you cannot separate it out in Medicaid because there's no way to do it with the data.
Well, plus, regular people are paying out the ass for this stuff.
On top of that, anybody who's not 65, okay, is taking it in the shorts. In some other way, whether it's in their health insurance premiums or whether they're, you know, it's coming out of their butt.
Plus, half of these companies, did you?
But Chief, it's not just there. Okay, here's the other thing. You know, you just got the CPI report. Okay, and hospital services are supposedly up, 3%. I don't have the CPI number directly in front of me right now, but I looked at it.
I'll dig it up while you're.
But I didn't see anything that was like screaming at me that we had big double digit numbers.
Eggs.
Eggs. Yeah. But not in medical services.
No.
Okay. In the breakdown of medical hospital services and physician services,
we never catch up on housing either.
They're not
either.
There. But here's the thing. Last year, well, and sometimes these numbers, but last, the hospital services payment amount out of CMS over last year is up 20%.
Oh, wait a minute. You don't expect the CPI number to be legit, do you?
No, but here's the thing. And physician, now remember, we just had, I don't know if you've seen these ads. They were all over X before I walked away from the platform. They're all over, I mean, these guys are paying.
Wait a minute, they kicked you away.
They kicked me away, kind of, sort of, and then I said the value proposition runs one way on this. You can bite me. My account's still there, but I killed all the content on it, I don't go there anymore.
I got prescription drugs up 4.6% year over year.
Yeah, well, BS, because the federal government, it's 80%. That's the run rate. Now, of course, we don't know what the rest of the fiscal will be through September 30th, right? We don't know yet. But this is all, and again, remember, most of this is off budget because these are not part of the discretionary budget. Okay, so this is not part of discretionary spending. This is outside the CR that has to be passed by tonight, or the government shuts down. It's entirely outside it. And the other thing is, physicians who have been screaming, you must improve the payment for physicians in Medicare. Physician payments are up 31% year over year.
Physician services, 2.6%.
Yeah, well, guess what? CMS has spent, compared against last year, same time period, has spent 31% more so far. Now,
have 30% more doctors. I don't think so.
No, we don't. Here's the basic problem, Chief. You know this because you understand basic mathematics and you've been in business and you've seen inflationary spikes and you've seen this kind of curve before. Every time that you create something that has a compound function in it. Every time this happens, it's simply a question of how long it takes before it does. And if you continue to play the compound game long enough, this happens every time. It's mathematics. It's not about political desires. It's not about somebody being an SOB. It's math. And math doesn't care about your politics. It doesn't matter whether you're liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican, or you vote for Marvin the Martian. It doesn't make any difference. You're going to get this result. And that's the reason I've been screaming about this, because this has nothing to do with what Chuck Schumer and everybody, McConnell before, not a more majority, but, still there, right? The fossils still there. It has nothing to do with the fossils on both sides. It has nothing to do with whether Hakeem Jeffries, or our current speaker, who I don't even like to use his name because I loathe that man so much. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the fact that you have a structure here that is exponential in its design, and it has been protected from competition and violations of federal law, which have stood on the books for over 100 years.
See, you shouldn't get me looking at stuff like this, Carl, because all I do is focus like an idiot. I'm looking here at dental services, right? Yep. Meaning your dentist, duh.
In the CPI.
Yeah, and now I have a dentist. I don't have dental. I just want to pay my own.
Right.
So I go 4 times a year for a cleaning, and 1 time he does all the x-rays. He's not gouging me, And I'm going to say that the cleanings are $1.25, and a day I have the x-rays, it's, 2-something. So we're talking $600 a year I paid a guy.
This is supposedly up 1.6%.
Well, no, but I'm saying the average median income from somebody is, say, $50,000. All right? So if this is $600, and I don't even have a cavity, and right. God help me if I needed a crown or a root canal something.
Oh, God.
God help you. So how the hell can dental services be 0.9 of my basket? I'm just getting cleanings, and it's 1.2. If I made the $50,000 a year.
Well, yeah, Chief. So here's the thing. If you want to see what happens when you allow unlawful things in the insurance industry to occur, right? And I'm going to be very clear about this. It is illegal, and it has been confirmed at the Supreme Court. So this is not speculative. It is a felony for an insurance company to insert itself into the pricing decisions and thereby restrict competition. And that was confirmed in 2 decisions that came out of Supreme Court in the late 70s and early 80s, because the medical insurance industry attempted to claim an exemption under McCarran-Ferguson, which is the law that regulates insurance and makes them, it's the reason that you have a Clue report. It's the reason the car insurance companies can share the fact that, well, they know that you had a wreck.
But
they
expanded that for insurance companies to share healthcare information or something. They've expanded that, and they get to go negotiate separately with hospitals. It never meant that,
Chief,
and they've taken it that way, right?
Chief, it's illegal.
I know, but I'm saying they have. I actually have one of my attorney buddies said, oh, they get to do this, and gave me the part about how they can share on the one side. I go, that's sharing on one side. That, it's not saying they can share on the other side. Where did that come from?
Chief, it's not...
Carl, you see what you've freaking done to me here now? Now I'm looking at eyeglasses and
Chief,
eye care.
It's a crime. It's a crime.
If you have a family of four, two of which need glasses or contact lenses, and everybody gets an exam once a year, how the hell is that 0.3% of your income?
It's insane. Okay, the CPI is ridiculously wrong. But here's where and this is why I say you have to start throwing people in jail. All right, here is the thing: if I have homeowners insurance and my house burns down, the insurance company does not get to do the negotiation with the guys that rebuild the house. Now, what they can do is say, well, you know what? You have replacement cost insurance up to X, which is what you bought, right? And by the way, if you exceed that, the rest is on you, right? That they can do. Same thing. Now, State Farm, years ago, this was 15 or 20 years ago, got spanked hard because they tried to play the health insurance game in car repairs and attempted to essentially force people with State Farm car insurance to use aftermarket parts.
I say they used the aftermarket. They got clobbered with that pretty good.
They got creamed.
Yeah.
All right. And the reason is that is a criminal offense.
They're pretty tight, though, with, how can I say this? Even now, though, I mean, I kind of know a little bit about this, Carl, more than I is.
Well, I have a very good friend of mine that's a master mechanic in the collision industry.
Well, I'm saying in Audrey's area, I have pictures on my, people would never believe this. Last April or something, they had the most dramatic hailstorm I think I've ever seen in the Chicago area.
Oh, yeah.
She was 4 inches deep on her deck. It knocked every single blossom off her pear tree. She didn't get one pear. I mean, it decimated anybody with, you know, fruit trees or anything.
Well, Chief, when was this?
This was 2 years ago.
So it was recent, because you know what? Literally the day I moved out of Chicago, the night before, we had a hideous hailstorm that came through, and I was going to get my boat from the rack because, you know, I was leaving permanently, right? And I'm in my car going to get it. I ended up hiding under an overpass because otherwise
it'll dent the hell out. But these guys,
it would have destroyed my vehicle. Yeah.
But I'm going to say that 50-60% of the people needed new roofs, and State Farm and those, they're real tight with the guys that are putting the roofs up. They all know the same cost.
We get the cockroaches around here whenever there's a bad storm too, and it's. But this is systematic, and the thing is, if you want to solve this, and if Trump and Doge and all that, if they had any intent of being serious about resolving this situation, all right, what you do is you go to the hospitals and the insurance companies, and you say, look, health insurance is a contract between the end user, the person that has a health problem, and the insurance company. That's the end of the conversation. If you reach across the aisle and pollute the pricing process beyond that, you're going to go to prison.
I seem to recall, I'm older.
Well, and here's the thing.
Didn't you used
Chief,
to pay the hospital and they reimbursed you?
Exactly. Yeah. Look, when I was growing up, all right, if I needed to go to the doctor's office, my mom wrote a check.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the bill got submitted to Blue Cross, and you got a check back from them.
Early on, it was your regular doctor. They just wrote a check. The only Blue Cross only came in if you went to a hospital. You had something.
Well,
bad
I understand
there,
that, but I'm saying that if there was something serious that went on, that's how that worked.
Right.
Okay. Now the thing is that we have, and that's because legally that's how it has to work. Your agreement is with the insurance company. Your agreement is that the insurance company has it, and again, this is what the insurance companies tried to do with Royal Drug. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they got smacked in the face.
Well, doesn't it cloud it? I'm not justifying it. Doesn't it cloud it up when the company has the insurance and they go through somebody who has a quote a network and they save some money by making you go to the certain? It is really clouded up. That's for lack of a better.
Chief, it's not clouded up. It's a felony.
Well,
we need to stop that. We need to stop with this cloudy.
I feel the same way. The thing of it is, you can't. Somewhere along the line, there needs to be a place to start. And by the way.
No, the way I, the you, way you. St-
I know you're going to say it again, but my point is that's not going to happen. Okay,
I'm going to say this: the way that look, you want to know where we go wrong in virtually every area of discourse when it comes to the economy and markets and politics is we don't call things what they are.
Without a doubt,
right?
Well, you're not going to disagree with me on that.
And you are never going to solve a problem.
Well, while we go to break, think back because you're in a business that had a lot of innovation. Think back on I was going to say, if you went to any saloon or library or coffee shop and started talking about getting rid of patent laws, you would, everybody's, their sphincter would slam shut, because they'd go, wait a minute,
but you wouldn't solve the problem let me finish.
So I'm saying, is if you, the idea that I can't go in my garage and invent something and get a right to use it for a while is so bad for people. They want people to do that in America.
Oh, absolutely.
While we're at break, see if you can think of one patent that you know about that was solely one person's idea and he didn't steal part of it from a university or somebody. I can't think of one, to be honest with you. SP Futures up 58, maybe the Hula Hoop. NASDAQ Futures up 272. Be right back. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. The Buy the Dippers, they're winning this morning, at least for a little while. Well, they've been winning all morning. The Buy the Dip. SP Futures up 56. NASDAQ Futures up 266. The Dow up 268. Most of the big seven, they got clobbered yesterday. Meta's up 13. They were really, really down yesterday. But all this stuff, but now they're, even Tesla's up $6 to 246. That thing has been getting hammered. We'll talk about what we did. Well, we'll talk about it right now, what we did yesterday. Yesterday was another crummy day. Dow was down 537, S&P down 77, NASDAQ down 345. So we're, if you're a Fibonacci dude or dudette, we're about two-thirds back. So you would say this is a Fibonacci bounce, because he's a big two-thirds kind of guy, even though he's dead. And his beard went, what, two-thirds away down the rest of his body or something? Anyway, I just brought that up. DAX up 439, 2%. FTSE up 58.7%. CAC around up 97.1.2. I am no technical guy. Maybe Carl will opine on that, but this better hold technically, because if it doesn't, it really looks bad. Nikkei up 263.7%. Hang Seng up 497, 2.1%. Shanghai up 60. Chinese stocks closed at 3-month high, despite the fall on Wall Street yesterday. Well, that's what they're doing. We'll talk to Carl about why that's happening. Bonds up 4 basis points, 4.32. So interest rates are going up, and the market's going up. That's a little unusual. The Bund, 2.93, that's up 8 basis points. We have not been that close, 1.4% apart in like a really long time, I don't think. Japan down 1 basis point, 1.53. Oil up 59 cents, but still mired in the high sixes, mid to high sixes, 67.14. Brent up 61 cents, 70.49. Natural gas down 6 cents, 404. Looks like it's diving under 4 here, maybe, as the winter is waning. RBOB unchanged, 214. Gold continues on a tear, up $16, 3,007. Silver up 47 cents, 34.78. Copper, we have a lot of people that are long gold and silver, and we've had a really good several weeks for our clients in that area. It's actually going up a little too fast. We didn't think it was going to go up this fast because we kind of piled on. Anyway, long story there. Foreign exchange, 109.05 on the euro, 129.3 on the British pound. The dollar kind of steadied out here. It was going down for a bit. Crypto up 3,000, 83,485. Like I said, everything's up this morning. Reinforced Trevi Weather Sports.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:38 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. We're looking at 49 degrees right now with a high of 71. Looking real nice today and sunny. Partly sunny, becoming windier and warmer. So there is an elevated fire risk today. Beware of that. Tonight will be a severe thunderstorm late in the evening. Mostly cloudy and windy with a low of 56 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 45 degrees right now with a high of 58. Mostly cloudy and cooler tonight. Will be cloudy and cool as well, with a couple of showers late, with a low of 48 degrees. Much like Chicago out there, you know, a little colder though. Traffic in Chicago, we're looking at 17 minutes. Iman Kennedy from Monroe's. Iman Enos from Lane Cook. 35 minutes. Iman Eisenhower from Wolf. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 24 minutes. And inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan is another 40 minutes. Let's talk about sports for a little bit. Yesterday, the Bulls beat the Nets 116 to 110, which is great. Today, we have Kings playing at Suns at 9 p.m. Yesterday, the Blackhawks lost to the Sharks 2-4. And for the MLB spring training, we have yesterday White Sox losing to the Brewers 3-9. And Diamondbacks Mariners game got canceled. Today, there might be a little bit of an overscheduling issue. Maybe you can help me out with this, Chief. Help me kind of understand this, clue this in. I see right here that there might be an both White Sox and Diamondbacks are to play Cincinnati Reds at 3:05 and 3:10.
They do a lot of split squad games in the springtime.
Because I see also that the Twins are playing both Orioles and Rays, and the Rangers are also playing both Rockies and Padres.
Well, you only got 9 on the field, and you got like 45 people you're looking at in spring training, so we have a lot of split squad games.
Right. Well, so just to recap real quick, White Sox and Diamondbacks are playing Cincinnati Reds at 3:05 p.m. and 3:10 p.m. respectively. Back over to you guys.
But spring training games are all about an afternoon in the sun, a couple of beers, you watch everybody, and nobody's all that good, and then you go and take a nap and go to dinner and do it all again the next day. It's not a bad deal.
I don't know. That's kind of like what double-A ball is like all the time. So
Yeah.
There you go. And by the way, it can be very enjoyable, especially, although I don't know, it's amusing because we have, the Cubs affiliate here, right? And they moved their stadium into this brand new thing that is constructed in Knoxville, 20 miles up the road. And the amusing part of it is that so far, as far as I know, now I haven't checked this morning, so maybe the numbers have dropped, but they have been spamming me to buy season tickets because I used to buy them fairly regularly online, so they have my email address, right? So they've been spamming the hell out of me on this, which I have zero interest in anyway. However, the price escalation there is crazy. But interestingly enough, the single game ticket price has not yet been announced.
Well, if I were you, and you like to go...
Why do I think it's going to be radically higher than what it was when it was stadium?
Probably, but if I were you, I would... If you decide to go down this road, if you have like neighbors or people who want to split them with you, I would go down and I'd make sure that I found a seat that I liked, that had some leg room because I'm a tall guy, and that you can see the game and there's nobody in front of you. If you can do that, then it's worth it in the season tickets. If you have somebody who go and...
Chief, one of the reasons I really liked having them here and the stadium we had is that I could decide at 3 in the afternoon I wanted to go see the game, and I could pick my seat. And I could get right behind home plate, just offset enough that I could see the ball come across the plate, and the catcher and the ump weren't in the way. Okay, and I'm three rows back from the front. And by the way, the ticket was $12.
Oh yeah, we can't beat that.
Well, and the beers were $5. Okay, and
I'll bet the beers are going to be $9.
Well, the other thing is that if you bought one of their mugs, which was a 22-ounce mason jar replica, but in plastic, right? So you could brain somebody with it. If you kept it, the refills were still $5.
Really? There you go.
But now they weren't pints anymore. Okay.
Plus, you were sitting next to Susan Sarandon, like in the...
I'm just saying, there was a reason I really liked having you and a gal could go $50. You could go get a game and maybe some nachos and a couple of beers and be right behind. Go ahead and try that crap at any major league.
It's not
a zero. But the thing, what we're dealing with, you talk about like the whole patent thing and the ripoff, which by the way is a huge problem. There's also a kickback problem in the drug industry, in that the people at the NIH and at these so-called nonprofit areas within universities, if they are the source of the patentable material, the original discovery, okay, and they frequently are because the government pays for most of this stuff through grants.
Well, plus people give grants.
Well, I understand that, but Chief, here's the thing. let's say that you're Fauci, right?
Yeah.
And you do some research and you write it up, your name's on the paper, and then, you know, this thing gets commercialized and somebody pads it. You're entitled to get a kickback on that. And you're a government employee.
Well, the part that I don't... first of all, I'm not going to say I couldn't get it, but generally Caucasians don't get sickle cell, but I think it's a horrible disease. So but generally you don't. But if I had $1 billion, I think it's a horrible disease. Yeah. I would if I had $10 million to flip around, I might very well give it to sickle cell research. I might give another $10 million for Alzheimer's research. Okay, oh, yeah. So if I give it to somebody and that guy comes up with a cure, where's my piece? I'm not in it for that, but where's my piece?
Well, and you know, I get that, all right, but we have...
Chicago, where's mine, Carl?
Chief, there's so many interconnected components of this, all right?
Yeah, and somebody walks out with this patent, who the hell are they?
I'm just saying, but here's the thing. If you tried to go at this, you know, trying to disassemble the haystack, all right, by going at these pieces like this with the patents and things like this, number one, you'll fail. But the reason you'll fail is not because you're wrong. It's because you're trying to unravel something that's too complicated at too low of a level.
You know, Carol, I don't know if you listen. I'll try. She's in a... I think she's trying to become a med physician's assistant. Katie, who was on the one day, was doing the research.
Right.
I was stunned when she said, oh, no, every one of these areas that they're doing research on, if it's this disease, if it's this whatever it is, where somebody's contributing or the doctor got this, because every one of them are accounted for separately with the hospital putting their big hunk over it on top. I had no idea. I'm not so sure it's as complicated as you and I both thought it, quote, was. I think you could trace it, not easy, but easier than you and I maybe would have thought 2 years ago.
Well, that's perhaps true. However, I do know where the pain point is from a standpoint of... Because here's the thing. If you want Congress... I mean, you know, back in the time that when I wrote Leverage, I put a part of... An entire chapter in the book is how to solve the medical side of this problem, because it's a huge piece of the escalating federal budget issue. Right? In fact, it is the most important component.
It's the gorilla in the room.
It is, and if you don't fix it, you fix nothing. So I spent an entire chapter on it. That and energy are the two places and the second one, the energy situation, is one that requires some very serious contemplation on the part of America generally, because you are asking people to make investments that have return periods measured in decades, and yet you can have your entire apple cart upended by a change in administration in the space of 2 years, because that's how quickly Congress turns over, or four in the case of the president. And Jimmy Carter is directly responsible for the near destruction of the nuclear industry in America, and he did it on purpose. He stated why he was doing it, and you may agree or disagree with his reason. Okay, which is fine, because that's, you know, the kind of debate we're supposed to have in a Democratic society.
That was a long time ago.
I understand this. And guess what? It hasn't been resolved in all those years since.
Well, there should have been.
We're 50 years down the road.
I know. So why didn't... But how does that affect the one you're always talking about, the salt or the solid fuel type things?
Because
he didn't even know about that.
Yes, he did.
Oh, he did. Okay, that was there at the time, right? I didn't know that.
Oh, we proved that worked in the 1960s.
Well, that seems pretty safe.
Well, here's the problem. In order for it to be commercially viable, in order for it to actually solve the problem, you also have to do online reprocessing. And what he did was he killed that industry.
That's right. There are a couple nukes going up now, though, right?
Well, so here you want to hear the ultimate irony? All these big companies that have been building data centers like crazy for AI and everything else, right? You know, the Metas of the world, the Amazons, Googles, Microsoft, that are, you know, the data center in every corner, right? Kind of like a chicken in every pot. for years, they've been on the green energy bandwagon. Solar panels, wind, da-da-da-da. All of a sudden, just in the last few days, they come out and they say, nope, nuclear or nothing. And this, and of course, there might be a reason for that. It's called, none of the other stuff pencils out, but nuclear does.
Well, so, they still need that breeder thing.
Well, you have to close the fuel cycle. That's the basic problem. Which is a, you know, that's what Carter killed. Okay, was the closing of the fuel cycle.
By the way, just as a FYI, as of March 2025, there are no new nuclear reactors actively under construction in the U.S. Although the Vogtle, V-O-G-T-L, how do you pronounce that, plant in Georgia recently had two reactors come online, completing the first new plant in the U.S. in three decades. So we just had a couple finished, but none under construction now.
Right. And the basic problem that you have with this is it's a long-duration investment that has a 40 or 50-year amortization schedule associated with it, and nobody in their right mind is going to put money on the table that they have to spend now and won't be able to cover it for that 40 or 50 years, even at the discounted rate, you have to borrow the funds or whatever, unless you can be reasonably certain that 3 years from now, when Trump leaves office, the next guy that comes in isn't going to shut it down. And because if he does, all the money you spent so far is gone.
Regardless of your feelings on the last several presidents, of which this guy's two of them, governing by executive order and changing all the other guy did the first guy in, whether you agree with what this guy did or the last guy or whatever, it's a horse bleep way of running government.
Oh, you've got two separate things here that if you want my opinion on where the biggest challenges are and that we have to solve them and we have to take the medicine that comes from solving them today. One is going to create a huge amount of economic dislocation, and that's resolving this health insurance BS. And the only way you're going to do it is Congress not only can't stop it, they are totally uninvolved in resolving.
You got to get them involved, because all right, we started out. We let this one slide here, though, Carl. How exactly am I looking at this table here? And physician services are up 2.6% on the year.
Right.
How the hell can they be up 30% in payments to that? I mean, how do these numbers get that far apart,
Chief? Because that's easy. Okay, all you have to do is look at what they have done with PBMs within Medicare Advantage programs, all right, and what Medicare Advantage has done to Medicare. Because if you want to know where the problem is coming from, it's there. And the reason is that traditional Medicare is an 80-20 program. And on top of that, you can't get rack rate charged because Medicare has an actual price list of what they will pay. And it is set in such a way, it's a consortium that puts the numbers together. But Medicare is prohibited by law from paying under cost. Now, of course, as you and I know, we can debate what real cost is, right? But they're prohibited from doing that. And if a provider challenges their determination on that and wins, they not only get the payment that they originally wanted, they get a penalty back from the government for trying to screw them. So typically doesn't happen. All right.
When I say physician, I got to keep. I can't stop myself. Is physician service meaning overhead charge by the hospital as well? It's not just what the doctor's getting paid.
Well, of course.
Yeah,
but here is the and that is where people get into the argument about, well, you know, what should the real billing rate be, right? Because overhead is always, of course, a big piece of this.
Oh yeah.
So here is the basic problem. Advantage is essentially a PPO. And I have warned people repeatedly about this.
You mean Medicare Advantage?
Yes. If you travel,
which is the supplemental insurance you get.
That's separate. If you choose Advantage on Medicare, Normally, if you're on traditional Medicare, you can buy the gap coverage, which is the supplement.
All right, just stop for a second. Let's. Okay. If you're over 65,
right,
included to you, I won't say free, included to you is the hospital piece.
That, well, you paid for it during your working.
Right,
years.
And
yes.
Then there's the doctor piece is called what? Is part B.
That's right. You pay an assessment for that and for D, which is drugs.
You don't have to do that, but you can.
No, you don't have to pay. You don't have to choose B either. However, if you
right.
opt
if you
out
if you do, it comes out of your Social Security checks. They're not sending you a bill and hope you pay it. They're taking it.
Right. And, well, and the other thing too, Chief, is that if you opt not to do it at 65, there is a permanent penalty rate that's assessed if you come back at it later, and it's hideous. So,
well, it's hideous depending on how long you go.
Oh, no, it's actually bad even if it's only a few months. You could,
well, I have a family member. It's like $10 a month.
I my mother got trapped by this when my dad died and didn't realize that she had to redo all of this.
Well, but your mom was innocent. Most people aren't.
Well, I understand she was innocent, but the fact is she got screwed out of about $1,200 a year for the rest of her life. Right.
Well, like I said, $10. Well, that's $120.
That's $100 a month.
But the mentality of this is, if you're 65 and you think you're healthy as a horse, which a lot of people do,
right,
you don't need no stinking prescription drug thing.
Right.
Well, insurance is all about everybody being in there, right? And
well, it's about you buy at a low cost because some people get screwed.
Well, right. But it's also now you make it to 70, and all of a sudden the doctor goes, oh, by the way, you're on this Eliquis I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, you have some Eliquis.
So
right.
what's the first thing you do? You go to Medicare and sign up for Part D.
Right.
And they go, well, that's an interesting idea.
Well, she's trying to buy fire insurance when your house is already burning is an interesting idea.
Yeah,
too,
it's the same principle, right?
Yes. But here's the point I'm trying to make, though, is this. So within the traditional program, the way it works is that they pay 80% of the bill and you pay 20. All right.
And that's where the supplementals come in.
And you could buy a supplemental program that covers that 20. All right.
Right.
All right. Now, there's also an option to instead buy an Advantage program. Now, Advantage replaces all of those other ones with one bill and one program. The problem with it is what the insurance companies have done with that is turned it into a capitation system. So they pay the local providers X dollars per person every month or year, and then they hope the people in their group don't use it.
Well, that's the same principle as an HMO.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, here's the problem. If you go outside their network because you're traveling or whatever, you're completely exposed even though you're on Medicare.
Without a doubt.
All right. So I have warned people.
They have some sort of an emergency room.
There are some, but the thing is that you can get badly screwed on Advantage.
Yeah, if you need open heart surgery and they're not letting you out of Phoenix and they're not in your district, you are in trouble.
You're in a lot of trouble. Yeah. And the thing is that the other problem with this is that what this does is this drives the sort of ramp job, because now you get into the whole PBM game, you get into the whole hospital game, you end up with problems where doctor's offices say, well, the capitation doesn't cover your expense because you're sickly and you're in here every week. All right. I don't want you as a patient.
Well, if you're a doctor, because my doctor did this for a while. The HMOs were kind of the same way. They'd say, okay,
right,
you're going to get $2 a patient for these 500 patients per month,
right,
or $10, whatever it is. And if everybody gets a flu the same week, you can't see them. you can't physically see 300 people.
You don't have the... Yeah, but this is the problem with these kinds of schemes, okay? But the way you break this is that you get rid of the ability, you get rid of the unlawful act. And the unlawful act is that the insurance company, their agreement is with you as the insured person. And therefore,
But it's not anymore. It's with the company. It's with someone.
You know what? Yeah, and it's illegal.
I get it, but I mean, that's why my question, and we'll talk about it next week, because we've been with all the various people, and you're closer to this than most, so I enjoy talking to you about it maybe more. But my question remains, if you and I get transported, Scotty transported us into the Oval Office, where do we start? Do we start with the patents? Do we start with the idea?
No. Where we start is where we can do it right now. Trump can say, by executive order, he can tell Pam Bondi and Patel, DOJ and FBI, every single medical provider is going to post one price, and everyone is going to pay the same price. And any contract that any insurance company or other entity has that says otherwise is a violation of 15 USC, and you're going to stop it now, or you're all going to get locked up.
And they're going to weasel around and say...
Well, they can try.
Well, but I'm saying it's not like...
No, you arrest
It's not
them.
Like every appendectomy is the same. They're not.
Chief, not every brake job is the same, and yet, yes, they are.
I'm saying that's where we would have to have a huge discussion on where... That would be your vote. It would be
Chief, tell me how the Surgery Center of Oklahoma does that. And they do, by the way.
I get it.
All right? So, yes, you can. All right? Now, does the auto shop know that your brakes are going to be rusted, the other guys are not? You know, I got to use air tools on yours and I don't on this guy's. No, he doesn't know. But what he does know is that he's got this many parts. You know, if you're doing an appendectomy, you use this many, you know, this many scalpels, this many sutures, this, you know, on average. Okay, it's an average, right? And this is the price. And I don't care how you pay for it, that's the price. Now, if you want to give me a discount for cash because it's better than sending a bill and maybe I don't pay you, yeah, you can do that. But, you know, what is that? The difference between that and the Visa?
Well,
using a Visa card's 3%.
Yeah, we got a dash here. We heard the president yesterday rant and raving against the Irish guy regarding drug companies that are in Ireland. Now, yep. I think that, you know, whatever, he can rant and rave, and he's probably got a point. You know the first drug company that went overseas? You probably know this.
No, I don't.
They're not around anymore. It was Forest Labs.
Okay, I was gonna posit that, but I knew it wasn't. I thought maybe it was Burroughs Wellcome, but then as I racked my brain, I realized it wasn't. Although they were the ones that made the huge amount of money on AZT that was completely.
But you know what they did? They took one thing Trump has said yesterday was correct. Is really dumb people let them do this stuff. They took, and this will be our final shot here. They relocated, I believe, to Bermuda. Might have been the Bahamas, one of the two spots.
Probably Bermuda. Bermuda was one of the places that they've been doing this.
But they, you know, you say, well, what good does that do? You're selling the stuff here. What they did is
you allocate revenues and costs.
No, they shifted the patents
right
to a sub company over there.
Right.
And for U.S. patents, they offshored and then paid rent to the patents where they
right.
Where
that's
they,
well. That's
they
what
shoved
I'm saying.
They shoved the
yeah. You play the games with the yeah with how that's allocated. Yeah,
I mean,
and essentially pay no taxes.
The only thing I was thinking about though, when Trump was doing his harangue, and I try to stay out of the political stuff, but I never seem to. You know what? He supposedly brought a lot of this money back on during his tax thing. From what I understand from my tax people, if you have a spot overseas now, you're better off now than you were before he supposedly fixed it.
Oh yeah.
So he didn't fix crap.
No, he didn't fix anything. But this is the problem with trying to go around the edges.
Yeah.
You have to go at the root of the issue, and the root of the issue is the unlawful acts which the administration can resolve and Congress can't block.
Well, it's also simple stuff. You sold it here. The income's here. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, but the same thing is, the Supreme Court said this law applies to insurance companies. That is not the business of insurance.
We got to go. I'm gonna fire one at you, Carl.
Behavior.
Before I wish you a good week, I'm gonna fire one at you, Carl. Nobody gives a crap what the Supreme Court says.
Yeah, well, we better start giving a crap, or we're gonna have a.
I just had a guy this morning.
All the asset.
I just had a guy pulling on the expressway, looked at the lights, blew right through the red light. Thankfully, he didn't hit me. You think he gives a crap about this? Is endemic up and down. Nobody pays any attention to anything.
Well,
you and I do. That's why.
Silver bracelets focus the mind.
Yeah, they do. SP Futures up 52. NASDAQ Futures up 240. Are we going to hang in here today or no?
I don't know. I you know what this bounces from Schumer saying he's going to vote yes on the CR.
Yeah,
that's when it turned last night.
Well, is it gonna, we've had all kinds of reasons why we're up in the morning and then we don't finish up. We'll hope this one hangs in there.
Well, you know what? There's no guarantee that his vote is enough to actually be, you know, convince enough people on the other side to cross. So you might see later on today as the vote counting starts. If that ends up being BS, and yeah, we're gonna that 54 handles on the spools are gonna
Tuesday. Let's talk a little bit about these metals. Are they going up because the European Central Bank's gonna start pouring money into the system? Or let's talk about it Tuesday. S&P futures up 54. Carl, have a nice weekend, buddy. On Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.